please the court. My name is Megan Casey. I'm here representing Michael Eberhardt in two appeals, one of a final decree and one of a quadro. As I know that the court has prepared for this hearing, I won't go into the facts. I'll just refresh the court that the main underlying issue regarding the final decree and the quadro is that the parties entered into a separation agreement on the record during the trial, on the day of the trial. And Mr. Eberhardt's position is that that contract controls all issues of equitable distribution and that the trial court erred in a number of ways by deviating from
Does your argument depend on how we interpret that first sentence in the agreement, whether this is a comprehensive agreement or whether it the court could grant ED on matters not covered by the agreement?
Well, the exact sentence in the agreement says that it is a settlement of all issues in the matter. So the court is required to use the plain language in a contract and to construe contracts according to the plain meaning of words used. And when the parties have agreed that it's a settlement of all issues.
How can it be? How can this non-undisclosed account be an issue in the matter if one party doesn't know about it?
Well, when parties settle cases, you assume the risks of settlement. We understand that there are risks to going to trial and there are risks to settling a case. And when parties choose to settle instead of going through the entire trial process, then they assume the risk that they may not be bargaining with all of the information that's available.
Well, hadn't there been discovery propounded that should have revealed the existence of that Roth IRA?
In all candor, Your Honor, my firm wasn't involved at the discovery stage, so I'm not sure why it got to this point where the account wasn't a part of discovery. And if the case had gone to trial, I certainly think that Mrs. Eberhardt would have had remedies as to this account. However, the parties did assume the risk of settlement, and they waived other issues by entering into what we consider a comprehensive settlement because it settled all issues in the case.
Counsel, could you remind me again the total amount of the account?
It was about $6,600.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I guess, well, speaking of that account, as the court's aware, the marital settlement agreements are contracts to be construed under typical contract law. The account was not mentioned in the agreement, and our position, as I think I just covered, is that because the account is not explicitly delineated in the account, the court was not allowed to perform an equitable distribution analysis of the account.
Because the account was not known to one side of the contract, does that mean that it's a mutual mistake or a unilateral mistake in the contract?
Well, there's nothing in the record to indicate that it was a mutual mistake of fact. I believe it was proffered at the December hearing that Mr. Eberhardt was acting knowing that he had this account, so it can't be a mutual mistake of fact based on the proffered testimony.
Does the record indicate that he deliberately concealed this account?
No.
It just wasn't disclosed? Is there a record of what happened?
As far as I'm aware, in my review of the record, and again, my firm was not involved at the discovery stage, the account was, we're not sure why the account wasn't disclosed, and I understand where the court's going with this, but unfortunately I don't have further information on that. All we have is the transcript from the December hearing, which indicates that, again, we don't know why it wasn't disclosed.
Then to follow up on Judge Huff's question, if both sides simply neglected to mention it in this on-the-record settlement, wouldn't that be a mutual mistake of fact?
Again, I don't think you can classify it as a mutual mistake of fact if one of the actors was aware of the account.
It certainly was a mistake. Whether it was mutual or unilateral, it still was a mistake of fact, wasn't it?
I don't think that you can say that it is a mistake of fact, because the parties agreed that it was a settlement of all issues. The macro point is that it was a settlement of all the issues, including the distribution as they knew it at the time.
It wasn't a settlement of all issues because it didn't touch upon what is clearly part of the marital estate.
Well, again, the parties assume the risk of settlement, and as is somewhat typical in our industry, parties can include provisions as to omitted property or after discovered property. I'm sure the court sees provisions like that frequently in separation agreements, and the parties had the opportunity to include a provision to that effect. Again, they assumed the risk of settlement, and they determined that that wasn't a provision that they wanted to add to their agreement. So it's a contract, and the parties are bound by it. I'll also point out that both the agreement and the stipulation as to those accounts specifically identifies each account. So it's not like there's a phrase in the agreement or in any of the stipulations that all marital assets are going to be divided 50-50. They specifically address each one. So it's not inconsistent with the agreement. It's just simply not addressed, and the parties are bound by the contract that they entered into.
The escrow funds that were refunded, the check had been made payable to both husband and wife, correct?
Yes.
But only the husband negotiated the check without the wife's participation or knowledge?
That's what we understand, yes, Your Honor.
And your position is that though the PSA, the property settlement agreement, was silent as to this, since it covered everything, what, possession is nine-tenths of the law? Is that where we're going with this?
I like that argument. The way that we analyze this particular account is that it's not a proceed from the sale of the house. It's reimbursement to Mr. Eberhardt of money that he paid into these escrow accounts during the pendency of the separation. The stipulation and the agreement discussed that he was the person paying the mortgage from February of 2017 until the sale of the house. The pendente light order speaks to Mr. Eberhardt was the party paying the mortgage on these accounts from September of 2016 forward. And both of those documents also indicate that historically he was the party who paid the mortgage on both of the items of real estate.
But the property settlement agreement provided some detail. The pay down on the equity of the house there would be compensation back to husband for that, but it was silent as to the refund on taxes and insurance for the escrow.
Yes, and I would tell the court that because the parties clearly knew how to be specific in this agreement when they meant to, by excluding that term and omitting that term, the Pocahontas mining case that's cited in both my brief and opposing counsel's brief does stand for the proposition that omitting a term is evidence that the parties meant to exclude it. So the parties clearly knew how to be specific as concerned the real estate holdings that they had and the fact that they determined not to include this term. Again, I would fall back on my previous argument. 2109 subsection C says that the court can't order equitable distribution that's not in accordance with the contract or the stipulation.
Is it doing equity to negotiate a check that's not made payable to you?
I think that's a little bit outside the scope of...
It's criminal.
Well, and it's a little bit outside, and I'm certain that
back
the
in my
parties...
former life, I think I prosecuted some people for doing that.
And I'm certain that the parties can seek remedy under other proceedings for that issue. But I believe that the interplay of 2107.3, 2109 subsection C, and 2109.1 indicate that the typical equitable distribution procedures, where the court takes evidence and looks to the factors, that those are not prompted by where we are in this case. The parties had an agreement, and because the parties had an agreement, the court should not perform an equitable distribution analysis. It's prohibited from performing an equitable distribution analysis because of 2109C, which says that the court can't order equitable distribution unless it's in accordance with the contract.
Well, if the contract is silent as to the escrow refund, how does one side benefit and the other not?
I don't think it's a benefit to him that is somehow excluding the wife in this case. It's his money. He was the, as I stated before, there's no evidence that he was the person, that anyone other than Mr. Eberhardt paid into these escrow accounts.
Wait, I thought this was all declared marital property that we're dealing with. And that's why it was covered by the property settlement agreement.
Well, I don't think that the escrow refund checks are, and I believe we distinguished this in the brief, they're not marital property because it was his separate funds that were paid into these escrow accounts. As the court knows, these accounts turn over periodically as payments are made to the insurance provider, to the tax, city taxes. So there's no evidence that any of the money in the account was actually marital property. Okay. I'd like to briefly discuss the quadro issue.
Yes.
As the issue with the quadro is that the court entered an order which provided gains and losses on wife's share of the 401k account. Pursuant to 2107.3k, the court is not permitted to enter orders unless they effectuate the intent of the final decree. The final decree in this case clearly indicates an exact date of valuation. It clearly indicates an exact dollar amount that is the amount of the account as of the date of valuation, and it also indicates the exact dollar amount that was to go to Mrs. Eberhardt as her share of this asset. So the court has visited this issue many times. We have the Fahy case, we have the Baker case, we have several.
Let me ask you, we recently decided a case that involved a quadro that was entered within the 21-day period in which the divorce case remains in the breast of the trial court. And we said that that order should be considered, the court had jurisdiction to effectively amend or alter its divorce decree. So therefore, it was not required that the so-called quadro simply effectuate the divorce decree. It could change the divorce decree.
Mm-hmm.
How does that case affect your argument?
I don't believe it does because the quadro was entered more than 21 days after the final decree. The quadro was entered about 30 days after the final decree.
Well, I thought it was entered at the same time. Am I mistaken?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
The final
your position is the court, yeah. The trial court was simply without jurisdiction.
Yes,
and, yes sir.
And other than quadro. Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry. I made a mutual mistake here. Or an unilateral mistake of fact.
And to your point, though, Your Honor, even if the quadro had been entered within 21 days, our position is still that the court couldn't have entered an order that awarded wife gains and losses. I know I'm sounding like a broken record a little bit here, but it was an omitted term from the stipulation. The agreement of the parties simply stated that the accounts would be divided as of the date of valuation. Again, the agreement didn't speak to that particular issue, so the court couldn't have ordered that relief for her. Going back to the final decree issues, one of the assignments of error that Mr. Eberhardt noted concerned a credit for attorney's fees that he paid on Mrs. Eberhardt's behalf.
Counsel, speaking of that credit, how does that align with the fact that you base your entire argument on the terms of the stipulation of the contract? And in that contract, if I recall correctly, there was no reservation in reference to that, even though that had already been paid, that $20,000. How do you explain that to me, please?
The exact wording in the agreement is that the defendant shall pay the plaintiff the amount of $65,000 for attorney's fees. There's no modifier. There's no qualifier. It's a plain reading of what that sentence says, and it says $65,000. So the fact that he had already paid $20 is a factor in the calculus in reaching this agreement. He already paid $20,000 of the fees, so the he should get a credit, and he was operating under the assumption that he should get a credit. And I realize what the court's getting at, that it, you know, it wasn't mentioned in the exact terms of the agreement. But again, it's the plain language. What the court, what the trial court did with its order was essentially order $85,000 in attorney's fees. And I'm also, you know, of course, glossing over the fact that there were additional attorney's fees ordered in the final decree for other, because of other issues in the case. But the trial court's order was essentially that he pay $85,000 in attorney's fees, and that's simply not in line with what the parties agreed to, as evidenced by the contract that they entered into. And I guess our last issue here is somewhat related. It again concerns this $20,000 payment on a credit card that Mr. Eberhardt paid on behalf of Mrs. Eberhardt. It's the same $20,000, and it's pled somewhat in the alternative to the attorney's fees argument. If the court is not convinced by the attorney's fees argument, the issue is that our position is that Mr. Eberhardt should have gotten a credit against the total equitable distribution award for that $20,000. The parties clearly stated in their agreement that they would allow for offsets of debts and credits, and it's our position that that's a general term, that it's not specific to the debts that are listed in the preceding paragraphs. The court, we believe, erred because it didn't give him a credit against the total award when the parties clearly anticipated that there would be an accounting of debts and credits paid by each of the parties in the total equitable distribution scheme. I guess I will retire early.
All right, that's fine. The remainder of your time is reserved for rebuttal. Thank you. For the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Emily Miller, and I represent the appellee Kimberly Eberhardt, the former wife, in this appeal of both a final decree of divorce and the qualified domestic relations order that you've already heard a little bit about today. This court, Ms. Eberhardt respectfully requests that this court affirm the both the final decree as entered and the qualified domestic relations order as entered, because both are consistent with the parties' agreement, and the court had the jurisdiction and the ability to order the equitable distribution that
well
occurred.
on the quadro.
Yes,
since you agree the quadro was entered more than 21 days after the divorce.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And
yes.
And that the terms in that the court entered were different from what were recited earlier in the divorce. How do you get around the jurisdiction
issue? I think, Your Honor, the distinction or the clarification in this cases, the actual terms of the final decree, if I may, are that this division, the division of the 50% as of the date of separation, shall be accomplished through the preparation of a qualified domestic relations order or other such document as the plan administrator requires. And that leaves the mechanism of the division to the quadro itself. The final
but the
decree.
The quadro can't change the terms of the order or the agreement. Would you agree with that? It can only effectuate it.
That's correct, Your Honor. It is.
So the agreement specified a specific amount of money.
It did.
And now the quadro has said a specific amount of money plus increases. So that's different, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor. I think that the distinction here, and it's actually as the dissent noted, and I understand that it's the dissent noted in Overcash that a quadro adding the quadro term of gains and losses did not alter a critical or substantive portion of the agreement and the final decree, but clarified an otherwise silent term. And in this case, it's a Fidelity 401k. Fidelity requires that they actually request that you use their form, and that has to be noted in that quadro. So it had to be decided either way, really. Obviously, Mr. Eberhardt's proposed order was that there were no gains and losses, and Ms. Eberhardt's proposed order that was ultimately entered by the court was that the gains and losses would be included. So I understand the court's question, and But it had to be ruled on, and we are where we are with respect to the order that was entered. I understand that's why we're here today. And I think in this case, as is noted in the brief with respect to the Quadro issue, the parties reached this agreement on the record on the day of trial, and these particular mechanisms of the division of the account was not addressed that day. I think everybody would love to think that they could do that on the record and hammer out every single detail and that.
Excuse me, counsel. May I interrupt you? The exact language, I believe, that's in the record, it says the parties by counsel have reached an agreement with regard to all issues in this matter. And you and counsel at the time represented that to the court. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That is.
And so now you're alleging that this is a partial agreement. How do you bring us to a partial agreement when you indicate initially that it handles all issues in the case?
Well, I think, Your Honor, many of the terms of the agreement, the parties did reach a final agreement as to how some accounts were being divided, how the spouse support award, things of that nature. However, the particular mechanics of some of these divisions was not addressed, as we've discussed here. I'll continue to discuss, and as opposing counsel's discussed, there were other terms that were either silent or were not included. I would offer that many of those as related to the final decree, that was the appropriate, that was what the parties agreed to. But with respect to some of these issues, counsel went back and forth and in drafting the final decree as happens, and these issues required the court to make a determination because it was not included. There are some silences
counsel,
in the agreement.
Then how did the court, as I read the record, the court really, it may have divided things that you requested, but the court didn't have a full equitable distribution hearing. There never was an equitable distribution hearing. Would you disagree with that statement?
Your Honor, I think there was. I guess the terminology of what that actual hearing, the December 21st hearing, mm-hmm. actually was, I think it was in the terminology in the court was that it was a trial on these remaining terms because the parties never actually had their trial in January because they reached the agreement on the record. So it did actually end up being a trial on equitable distribution issues because the parties requested it. And as this court has found in PARA, that is one of the prerequisites of the court making an equitable distribution determination, is that it was before the court.
Did the wife ever request the court to declare that the agreement was unconscionable because it was procured by fraud and misrepresentation?
No, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that be a prerequisite to coming here today? That the entire agreement would be abrogated and the court would proceed to equitable distribution on its own terms?
That's an interesting point, Your Honor. I'm not sure that that is a prerequisite for the circuit court to make some of these rulings as the parties requested that they do so. And it is Ms. Eberhardt's position that the rulings from the December 21st hearing were consistent with the parties' agreement. As it relates to the final decree, with respect to the Fidelity IRA account that has been discussed here today, as Your Honors noted, the same was not disclosed throughout discovery. My firm was counsel of record at the time, and it wasn't disclosed. And actually, the circuit court requires that it's as included in the record before the court that equitable distribution worksheets are submitted. I'm not in Mr. Eberhardt's mind. I can't speak to his intent, but that was a court submission and was not included on that form.
And it's a local rule that requires the full disclosure of all the assets that are involved in the marriage.
Yes, Your Honor. And as the record indicates, it's undisputed that that's a marital account. It just simply wasn't included, and the division is consistent with the rest of the account divisions. 50-50 as the date of separation. Ms. Eberhardt's not receiving the whole account or anything of that nature. There was no admitted property provision in that in the agreement on the record. And I think this particular account is distinguishable from the other issues that we're talking about today with respect to the Pocahontas mining rule of the omission of a term is evidence that is meant to be not included because there was a no knowing waiver of this account because it wasn't known to Ms. Eberhardt at the time, despite it being a part of the discovery process, should have been disclosed.
Counsel, let's just assume hypothetically that we agree that this is a partial agreement and it goes back in reference to the equitable distribution. You allege that the court had a full equitable distribution hearing, but where on the record can you point to that the judge went through all of those issues that are required pursuant to statute? I couldn't find them. Can you point to those on the record? So even if you're correct, it would have to go back for an equitable distribution hearing, wouldn't it?
I understand, Your Honor. Are you referring to the factors in 20-107.3?
Yes.
I think, you know, it's kind of, I guess it's a little bit tricky here because it was a more limited equitable distribution hearing, and Your Honor's correct. I think the circuit court heard the evidence at that hearing that day and had the record from the party's agreement from January and made rulings that were consistent with that agreement in, attempting to help the parties interpret some of these silent terms in that agreement. And with respect to the refund checks issue that was discussed previously, the terms of the agreement do state that the parties, they are very specific, actually. I would completely agree with opposing counsel and say that the parties did know how to negotiate very specifically with respect to that provision. Mr. Eberhardt received the rental income because he was paying the rent. He was paying the mortgage on the rental property. He received credit for principal pay down. He was aware of all of these facts at the time, and there was no discussion and there was no inclusion of the refund checks into the parties' agreement. And more importantly, as Your Honor has noted, the checks were made out to both parties. So even if it wasn't addressed in the agreement, which it was not, the check was made out to both parties. It should be cashed out to both parties. And I won't get into any, I'm not sure of the circumstances of how that cash was checked otherwise. Check was cashed otherwise, but it is Ms. Eberhardt's position that ruling was made in accordance with the agreement and also just appropriate given that it was made out to both parties. With respect to the attorney's fees issue, the agreement, as opposing counsel has noted, states that Mr. Eberhardt will pay Ms. Eberhardt $65,000. Again, the omission of the term credit is evidence that it was not intended to be included. Mr. Eberhardt was aware of that $20,000 charge at that time. It had already occurred, had the ability to negotiate for that.
That had been disclosed to both parties. Both parties were aware that was in the past.
Yes, Your Honor. It was. It occurred in the period of time after the party separation and before a pendente lite hearing over, I think, about a year and before that. And he had the opportunity to address that in the agreement if he so chose. And the same is true with respect to the $20,000 overall credit towards the equitable distribution payment. The terms of the agreement actually state specific balances as of the date of separation and say that the credit will be applied to those balances just referenced. And as the court has held, the court interprets the agreement using or the contract using the terms, looking to the terms themselves, and it references those particular balances. It does not account for a credit, allows for a credit on those particular balances. And I think that, overall, the rulings that were made on December 21st, which were unfortunately necessary because this matter did not resolve itself at the agreement stage, it had to continue for quite a bit longer. The court made those rulings in accordance with the party's agreement. And, I understand that the quadro, returning to that issue, is the final decree says what it says, but when the parties reached that agreement, it actually says in the terminology of the agreement on the record that this was to be accomplished within a matter of weeks. And there we were over a year and I think 3 months later, and it wasn't done. And Mr. Eberhardt got the benefit of that account. He's the account holder. He got the benefit of everything up until that point of time, whereas Ms. Eberhardt unfortunately received nothing and was in a pretty tough position that entire time.
Wasn't she receiving support?
She was receiving spousal support, Your Honor, but none of the other payments have actually yet been made. And so the court has the ability, as was in the Venable case, and the prim matter to consider the equities and the interests of the parties in making this ruling, and it was equitable. And you know, Ms. Eberhardt is for her position that the quadro as entered reflects the intent of the parties in the agreement and is consistent therewith, and also it would be unjust enrichment to Mr. Eberhardt should his proposed version be entered. And I guess I'm a little bit, if Your Honors have no further questions, Ms. Eberhardt respectfully requests that the court affirm the circuit court's entry of the final decree and the quadro and deny Mr. Eberhardt's appeal.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank
Miller.
Your Honor.
Ms. Casey, any rebuttal?
The only points I would like to reiterate with the court is that concerning the quadro issue, it's not an issue of equity. The code is very clear that the court is not allowed to enter an order that doesn't effectuate the intent of the final decree. So I understand sometimes the law rewards people you don't necessarily want to reward, and I stand here in full knowledge of exactly what happened, you know, exactly what's gone on in this case. But unfortunately, the code section states what it states, and it's not an equitable issue that was within the discretion of the court. The court had to, pursuant to the code section, enter a quadro that did not allow gains and losses, because that's what the final decree indicated. In terms of the final decree issues, Judge Chavin, you noted that there was no equitable distribution hearing, and just to reiterate, the transcript of that December hearing is, except for a few brief moments, entirely the attorney's proffering. Just to reiterate that point, it's not an equitable distribution hearing. While some exhibits were handed up to the court, it wasn't an evidentiary hearing. The parties didn't testify other than a brief colloquy about how to get pictures off of a computer. It was a proffer. It wasn't an evidentiary hearing. And as to the claim that the division of that IRA account was consistent with the spirit of the agreement and the rest of the terms, I believe I mentioned in my previous discussion that the accounts were specifically listed in both the stipulation and the agreement. If the court looks at the actual stipulation as to accounts that was entered on the record, there are a number of accounts that weren't divided 50-50. So to say that this division was consistent with the agreement is incorrect. A number of the accounts were gifted to third parties, including the parties' children. So it wasn't as if there was a uniform distribution of retirement and investment accounts on a 50-50 split. There were other accounts that weren't divided on a 50-50 basis. And so for all the reasons mentioned in our briefs and here today, Mr. Eberhardt requests that you grant his appeal, that you remand the quadro to the circuit court so that an appropriate quadro can be entered or a subsequent order can be entered that effectuates the terms of the final decree, and that the court remand the final decree so that Mr. Eberhardt can get the various credits discussed against his total equitable distribution award.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
In keeping with the traditions of this court, we will step down and greet